This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to The Commercial Investing Show, where we analyze, explain, and exploit the opportunities presented in today's commercial property marketplace. If you're interested in apartments, mobile home parks, self-storage facilities, and other income property, you've come to the right place. We'll explore what's hot and what's not in markets nationwide in the relentless pursuit of return on investment. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome George P. Newberry to the show. He is the founder and CEO of American Homeowner Preservation, otherwise known as AHP. They are a socially responsible hedge fund that purchases non-performing mortgages from banks at big discounts and then shares these discounts with the families to settle their mortgages. They basically do workouts with those mortgages. He also is the author of at least two books, maybe more, I'm not sure. One is entitled Burn Zones, and it's about his amazing story of making a ton of money and then getting into big trouble and doing that in real estate. And then his book, Debt Cleanse, which is about some of the specifics he learned to come back from that and get back on his feet. George, welcome. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me, Jason.
Good, good. Well, you know, Horatio Alger popularized the rags to riches stories, and maybe yours is a rags to riches again story. I don't know. But we will see. We will see. Give us your backstory quickly, if you would, about how you had purchased all of these properties and then ran into some trouble. And let's kind of dive into that.
Sure. Here's what happened. I was a high school dropout. I was racing bikes for a living until I was about 25, at which time I realized that I needed to get a real job. And I was able to get a job at a mortgage company. And within 6 months, I was a top producer. And 2 years later, I started my own mortgage company. And from there, I started buying buildings. In 1992, I bought a 4-unit apartment building and then a 19-unit apartment building and kept buying until about 10 years later, I owned about 4,000 apartments across the country, including one of the largest complexes in the country, which was named Woodland Meadows. It was 1,100 units in Columbus, Ohio. And I typically buy the most challenged properties, the ones that other developers had had big trouble with. And true to form, I bought Woodland Meadows. It was in bankruptcy. It was nicknamed Uzi Alley for all the crime and drugs and gangs which had infested the neighborhood. And I set about turning it around and had some great success doing so. The challenge is that the property got hit by an ice storm, which just devastated the property. And I didn't know this at the time, but although I was well insured, I had close to $50 million in insurance. If you have a big claim like I had, the insurers will try to find ways to not pay you. And so they initially denied the claim, and I ended up suing them. You know, I was optimistic that eventually I'd get the money, so I started borrowing money against my other properties, which generally were doing quite well, in order to do the renovations at this property. And the costs ended up being extraordinary, and the insurer just kind of waited until I got desperate. And desperation, the number's going to sound funny, I settled for $32 million. So clearly a lot of money, but the damage was over $45 million. And so it was a big gap.
This was Cleveland, you said?
It was Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio. Okay, we've done business in that market, and we've done multifamily in that market for our investors. So it was in Columbus, and was this like 300 units or something like that? It was a big complex, right?
1,100 units.
Wow.
On 54 acres. Just one of the biggest properties in the country.
What did it cost you to acquire that property?
I bought it for $12.5 million.
That sounds like a great deal.
Yeah.
I sold a 125-unit complex I owned with a client of ours for $8 million. And, you know, that was only 125 units. So
sure.
that's amazing. Wow. Okay. So you bought it for $12 million. That sounds like an incredible buy. And how much was the damage? The claim, you settled for $32 million, but what was the damage that you were asking
for? Probably $47 million in the end. It's just, it's astronomical to think about it today. Yeah. And you know, I clearly made some mistakes. I hired a big disaster remediation firm, a global firm, which said, hey, we're experts at this. We're going to make sure, you know, you get this all covered by insurance. So I hired them, and they were, you know, they had hundreds of people a day there working, but they ran up just these astronomical bills.
Was that like ServPro or a company like that?
It was a company called Belfour, B-E-L-F-O-R.
Okay.
They were, it was a big mistake.
Yeah.
And that didn't work out well for me. And I kind of put my trust in them and it was a mistake. I'm sure they made a lot of money on the deal, but I didn't make a lot of money on the deal.
Yeah.
I ended up losing everything. You know, where it went wrong, I mean, there were all kinds of options. I could have closed the property as soon as the storm happened, which is probably what I should have done. But I was determined that I'm going to rebuild. I also had utilized low-income housing tax credits as part of the financing. So if those were to go, I'd have lost, you know, the revenue stream from there. I was due to receive $1 million a year for 8 years. I mean, all kinds of good things. And all I had to do to get $1 million a year for 8 years was to keep the property at, I believe, over 80% occupied. I mean, these were, it was so easy, except, you know, this made it impossible to rebuild. And, you know, kind of had my tunnel vision, which had served me so well as a bike racer, and then amassing this massive portfolio of real estate. I was, you know, I just worked really hard and, you know, saw things to the end. And this is the one time that it just didn't work. And it really unraveled everything I'd done over the prior, you know, 14, 15 years was now gone. And not only that, not only did I lose everything, but I actually ended up, it's laughable in retrospect, but I ended up $26 million in debt. After all, everything else was taken from me or gone. And there was a little bit of I share this in my book, but there was a little bit of, I wasn't aware, but I was running at a little bit of a disadvantage. The city of Columbus really wanted this property. It was the largest property in the city. It was 54 acres, and they really wanted it. And in the end, they got it, and they own it today. And so, you know, later on, as we started doing this renovation, I kept getting no pass, you didn't pass. And I was like, you know, what is going on? How are we doing such a bad job? We just can't get these inspections passed. But it turned out, I later did a book signing in Columbus a couple of years ago, and this inspector came up to me and said, hey, we were told no matter what you did, to fail you. And there was no way I was destined to lose, and I just didn't recognize it at the time.
So, I mean, that's a clear sign of government corruption. We were told to fail you no matter what. And this is what scares the heck out of me about government. You know, these bureaucrats, if they just have it out for you, if they just want to get a promotion and, you know, improve their career, they can just ruin people's lives. There's just virtually no accountability when it comes to government. They have unlimited budgets. I've interviewed people. It's just, you know, the government has essentially criminalized everything. So everybody's a criminal nowadays. I interviewed the author of 3 felonies a day on the show.
Oh.
Fascinating look at that problem that we have. But that's not even really what we're talking about. I mean, so why were they told to fail you? Did you learn anything more about that? I mean, that's just scary.
I mean, they wanted the property. Apparently, they made me an offer. And in hindsight, this was the tipping point. I was summoned, and that's how the newspapers put it in the headlines, because this was a big news story back then in Columbus. I was summoned to the mayor's office with all my financials and my reserve reports, all this stuff, and I agreed to go. And at that meeting, they made an offer, which I should have taken, but at the time it didn't make sense to me. They said, hey, we'll help you move. I had a big HUD contract down there. We'll help you move the HUD contract, buy another property in Columbus. You can move the contract over there, and we'll support that. And I was saying, hey, but all these low-income housing tax credits, I'm going to lose millions if I do that. I have to rebuild this property. And they really encouraged me. And it seemed a little bit awkward that the city is telling me to, you know, don't rebuild the property, go somewhere else in the city of Columbus and do business there. I guess I just didn't play the game very well. And they were saying that we want this property.
What are they using it for? Is it like city housing? Is it a government housing project now? Or what?
No, they had big plans to do some commercial development there. But in the end, the recession hit, and they ended up building a high school on just a portion of it. They have a big high school there. And I was out there a couple of years ago when I did that book signing and I drove by it. They have the high school on maybe 10 or 15 acres, but then the rest of it is still a huge vacant lot, which they were planning.
So did they bulldoze the entire complex?
Yeah, they took down all the buildings.
So they took down 1,100 units and they built a high school on part of it and the whole, it's just vacant land now? That's crazy.
That is. It is absolutely crazy. They spent $2 million to demo it.
Where did they put all those people? I mean, they just evicted them all? That's just...
They relocated them. Now, when this was all happening...
And let me guess, they relocated them to the brothers' apartment complexes or some corrupt scam like that.
Probably. They gave the tenants were generally behind me and backing me up until they went out there. The city and HUD went out to the property and said, everybody at this property who's a tenant will get a HUD voucher to move wherever they want. And
so
all
this was all like Section 8. So everybody was a Section 8 tenant there? Was that
even the people that weren't Section 8 got Section 8 vouchers?
Okay. All right. Wow. Okay. Go ahead.
So at that point, everyone was saying, well, I got to do what's best for my family. And, you know, I can move to the suburbs or I can move back home to Atlanta and still have a voucher. And
Right. Everybody
left. And I remember I was at that announcement meeting. I was just, I mean, this is going from bad to worse. And then the city planted a story. The mayor's spokesman spread to the Columbus Dispatch, which is the big daily there, that, hey, he's under criminal investigation. Mm-hmm. Now, no one said for what or anything like that. So I called it was in the paper the next day. So I called my attorney and saying, what are they talking about, a criminal investigation for what? And so my attorney called the city attorney. They said, no, there's no criminal investigation. But just the fact of spreading it out in the news, it was, you know, all of a sudden I went from being, oh, you know, this is a bad guy. I hadn't done anything wrong, and I was a hero before this because I turned around this chaotic property, but all of a sudden I was a zero. And, you know, I see it when people in big politics, you see these people all of a sudden fall from grace, and all of a sudden, you know, they're under investigation. I mean, I went from being, not only was I purportedly under criminal investigation, which was a complete lie, but all of a sudden the IRS said, hey, we need to audit your tax returns.
Of course. Conveniently, suddenly they want to audit you. It's just amazing. And you know what is even more scary about this type of stuff is that the government, and, you know, by the way, I should just make the disclaimer, I don't know what happened. Maybe you are a bad guy. I don't know. Okay. You know, we're just hearing your side of the story, obviously. But the government has so many odds in their favor. It's so stacked against you no matter what, because they can just leak a casual comment. You're under criminal investigation,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly your life is destroyed, right? It's just it's a very unfair balance of power. But a lot of these government investigations or prosecutions end up with a settlement where the person that the government is coming after has to sign a gag order and they can't even talk about it. So for the rest of their lives, they got to take the secret to the grave. Yeah. Like at least you're talking about it and someone's hearing your story. But a lot of these folks, you will never hear about them ever, you know, because the government made them sign a gag order. You know, they'll go to jail if they violate that. So it is super scary. And listen, I've been in a few litigation cases in front of judges that I believe are totally corrupt, you know, having ex-party conversations with the other side. I was in a Kansas City case like that. It was clear. I mean, we had absolute proof. The judge and the other side's lawyer were having these ex-party conversations. They were chumming up together. Every ruling was in the other side's favor. It's just disgusting. I mean, it's unbelievable. And they're just immune. You know, they can pretty much do whatever they want. You know, you can't do anything about it. I want to move to the next part because that story, as bad as it is, let's talk about what you did afterwards. Okay, so you lost the property. You lost a bunch of money. Just one question for you, though. How did you acquire that property? I mean, $12 million is a pretty good deal, but did you raise money? Did you do it through the low-income tax financing, or was it your own money, or how'd you do it?
Sure. So I had $2 million cash, mm-hmm. which I just made.
Just your and own then, money. Okay, right.
Just my own money. And then I got a loan for conveniently $12.5 million, which included $2 million towards renovations. I came up with another $8 million in renovations over the subsequent year and a half. And that's how I put together the money. The loan that I received was essentially a hard money loan. It's for 1 year. At the end of the year, I refinanced everything with a bond issue from Franklin County and low-income housing tax credits. The bonds were purchased by Allstate Insurance. So it was, I mean, at that point in that year, I really, the property had turned around in an astounding fashion where I was getting, at that point, 8% financing, which at that point was pretty attractive. Today, not so much. And then all this equity from the sale of the low-income housing tax credits. So it was a compelling transformation financially and for the property in general. Mm-hmm. Everything was going the right direction until the ice storm hit.
All right. Okay. So talk to us about your book, Debt Cleanse, and some of the things that you did after the fact to get back on your feet. You know, I'm assuming you're kind of back on your feet now. Maybe you're not. There's a lot of stuff that consumers just do not know. And during the Great Recession, I did shows with people that talked about strategic defaults and, you know, like millions and millions of people were just giving their houses back, even if they mm-hmm. had the money. I think that's I came to terms with that strategy. I think it's legit because basically the contract, when you buy a property, says this. And look, I'm a lender. I have, I don't know how much out right now, but I probably got about $2 million, maybe more, $2 million or more out in loans I've made to other people right now as we speak, right, on properties that I've financed. Or my companies have, I should say. And, you know, but it's essentially my money, right? Mm-hmm. And the contract says you either pay the mortgage, or you just return the collateral. It's quite simple. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. That's the agreement, okay? So you always have the option to just return the collateral and walk. And millions of people did that. And I interviewed a lot of people, you know, over the years on the show that talked about strategic defaults and so forth. And a lot of times it was the smart decision, right? That's on the mortgage credit side. And there are lots of ins and outs in doing that. And, you know, you got to be careful, obviously, and treat everything with respect. But there's a lot of other types of consumer financing issues. And, you know, these debt collectors are, many of them are like the scum of the earth. They just break the law wantonly. You know, it's mind-boggling the way they take advantage of people, especially unsophisticated people. Talk to us about Debt Cleanse a little bit and, you know, give us kind of the premise of the book and tell us a little bit about it. Share some good techniques.
Absolutely. So I was, again, $26 million in debt. I explored filing bankruptcy and I just couldn't do it. I was always optimistic. I knew at some point I'd get some traction again and move forward. And I thought a bankruptcy would be a big negative, obviously, and that some way or another I was going to try to find my way out of this pile of debt. And I'll tell you, a creditor made a mistake on one of my mortgage loans secured by property in Kansas City. And I recognized the mistake and seized on it and actually pursued the creditor all the way. The lower court found in my favor. They appealed it, went to the Missouri Court of Appeals, highest court in Missouri, and they found unanimously in my favor. And basically, the decision read that the creditor's attorney had inadvertently extinguished their debt. So the debt was gone. It was over $5 million, which I was at a very, very low point. And all of a sudden, wait, okay, so I just won. And I spent all this money and time on these attorneys, but we won. And now I see a little bit of clearing this pile. And I said, what about these other creditors that I have? Let me look in their documents. Let me look in their legal pleadings. Let me see if any of them made mistakes. And here's what was fascinating. Small bank, small creditors, big banks, they were repeatedly making errors. And so I started creating a system where I could look proactively, look through all the correspondence, look through any other communication, look through the original loan documents, look through the legal pleadings, and find errors, and then basically exploit them. I'd find a reason to fight back. And I had some pretty good success to the point where I eventually wrote a book, because I have friends who call and say, hey, my sister or my mom, they can't afford their mortgage. What should they do? And instead of like going one by one, well, they should do this, this, and this, eventually, hey, here's the book. And this will tell them step by step. For instance, there's a chapter on mortgages, which will step by step, about 40 steps, which most cases you won't have to do them all, but it starts from the beginning and you just go through the steps until you achieve a settlement that's satisfactory to you. In most cases, a mortgage, you're going to settle. If you want to keep the home, you're going to get an attractive modification. If you don't want to keep the home, you'll probably get cash for a deed in lieu and all kinds of types of other debts. As you get to credit cards and things that are unsecured, payday loans, those are things in most cases you won't settle for anything. You'll just eliminate the debt. And that's what I found. And so I spread the word. And the goal is not for people to go out and buy stuff and then not pay. That's not the goal. The reality is in this country, there's millions and millions and millions of families who cannot afford their debt. And the only way many of them are sustaining themselves is that they are getting more credit. Right. At some point, that has a bad ending. And so the goal of the book is to show them how to proactively take control of that of their finances and either settle their debts for pennies on the dollar or not pay them at all, and then not to take on new debt. Then maybe go ahead and live without credit, or just a credit card for travel and stuff like that. But you don't need to have credit in many cases, and you can live a pretty good life. And that's what the book shares.
Well, I love debt. I mean, I always jokingly say, kind of half jokingly, I guess, that debt is my favorite four-letter word, because it is a very powerful tool to grow wealth. You know, it has to be used carefully, obviously, and has to be used with respect. But if you look at the big picture of this stuff, and this is something that, I think it was in Rolling Stone magazine, of all things, that there was this big expose, you know, talking about Goldman Sachs and the bubble machine. It's a very famous article that, you know, came out like maybe 2006, 2007, circa that era. When you look at this, the big picture, and maybe a little bit conspiratorial, is that the powers that be that really run the banking system are so incentivized to create these constant credit bubbles. I mean, when the Federal Reserve was formed over 100 years ago, one of their promises was that they would smooth out the economy and we would not have these big roller coaster type looking graphs, right? And it's only gotten worse since then. You know, I mean, a lot of people will, you know, be an apologist for the system and say that they have done their job. But, you know, right after that, we had the Great Depression and then we had the Great Recession 70 years later, and we've had a million other ups and downs in the cycle. You can see from looking at the big picture that over the course of time, it is in the interest of the banks and the creditors and the Fed to create these big, and in really the interest of the ultra wealthy, ultimately, because that's who ends up getting the profits from all of this, to create these bubbles, to run up asset prices and make them really, really high, and in debt, you know, get the whole population in debt, and then create a contraction and a subsequent crash, and then buy those assets back at, you know, pennies on the dollar, and then turn around and ruin everybody's credit so everybody feels like they're the guilty party, right? Everybody in the general public, you know, the middle class and the lower classes, and they feel like, well, yeah, of course I have to pay more for financing now because my credit is bad. It's my own fault. I got myself into this. And, you know, on the surface, it kind of looks that way. But when you really step back and just look at the really big picture, you can see how the whole system is incentivized to do this. Thoughts? Wall Street included.
I think you described it. I mean, the Wall Street is designed to extract wealth from the low and middle classes and even the upper middle classes. It's a tragedy. And you see these, just as you described, I mean, you see people who are of the most modest incomes in the country who are paying the highest interest rates. I mean, they're taking out payday loans and things like this, yeah. Very predatory financial products. And this boom or bust, I mean, it's a tragedy. It really takes a toll on millions of Americans. And the question is, can they just keep doing it? Or is there an end? Currently, it is contributing to this significant widening of the wealth gap and the wealth gap and the income gap in this country. And that's going to end badly. You can't just have this, the elite and everybody else. Yeah. It needs to be a healthy society. People need to be able to contribute and share in a society. And right now it's becoming much, much too divided. And
the wealth is becoming much, much, much more concentrated. Yeah, there's no question about that. And it's all, if you ask me, it's all by design. Okay. It really is. And that's, you know, that's the way it works. So the question is, we need to be knowledgeable. We need to arm ourselves. We need to fight back. And that's why I love being a consumer advocate, because I really have a passion for helping the underdog. That's what you've got to do. So any specifics, talk about, since most of the audience is real estate investors, any specifics just before you go on the mortgage side of it, okay? Now, you got some justice in Missouri. I have found that state to be full of scumbags. I mean, we've dealt with so many scumbags in Missouri, I can't even begin to tell you. Sound like you did pretty well there, so congratulations to you. But, you know, anything more on the mortgage side, how to do workouts? I mean, you do this from the other angle now. You do workouts as, you know, the one who's buying these discounted notes and then, you know, offering them to the borrowers to get out of the deal. What tips would you have for borrowers?
So number one is don't pay. I mean, if you can't afford to pay, don't pay. Many people will borrow money on their credit cards, take out personal loans, borrow from friends and family in order to keep themselves afloat for a little longer, hoping that there's some big solution in the future. But many a times, as often as something good happens, something bad happens. So be realistic with the circumstances. And if you can't pay, stop paying now. That's where you get the most leverage. And then the number one rule of advice is if you are in trouble, call your lender, call your servicer, let them know your circumstances and try to make a deal. I would say it's complete opposite. Don't talk to them. As a creditor, my most frustrating situations are when the people refuse to talk to me, because then you don't know what's going on. You don't know what's in their head, and you leave just this gap, and you want to be the exception. You want to be the one that they're having to say, okay, we got to put some extra resources on this one.
Here's the problem. That sounds, what you said sounds like an obviously good policy, right? The problem is, and this is one of the ways that the corporatocracy takes advantage of everybody, is that they're going to send you to some call center of an idiot reading a script in the Philippines. It's so endlessly frustrating. They will just waste your time incessantly. And that's the problem. You know, you're not talking with a rational American who can actually think and make a decision. You're talking with a script reader in the Philippines. And it's just harassment, essentially. You know, you can't talk to them. Any thoughts there?
No, you're absolutely right. You're going to be talking. No one who you're going to be talking to when you reach out to the lender for help is going to have any authority. So if you don't talk to them and you wait for them to make a move, a legal move typically, where they start foreclosure on a mortgage, when they start foreclosure, now there's going to be an attorney assigned to the case, and then eventually and they'll have somebody at authority at the lender to work with. But before they even get to that point, you can do a qualified written request. Total hassle for mortgage.
A QWR. We sold a QWR letter during the Great Recession to people, and a lot of people bought that. You know, it was just a nominal fee. It was this giant letter, you know, that the lender would have to come back and provide, you know, like hundreds of pages of documents. A lot of times they couldn't find them because they bought your loan in a pool that was sold 33 times. Your loan was sold to 33 different parties. It's a total scam. Wall Street is a scam.
I agree. We get those letters. It's just a showstopper. It's so frustrating to respond to them. It takes significant man hours. If they have an attorney, we're on the phone with that attorney saying, what does your client want? And that's where every one of your listeners, if they get in trouble, that's where they want to be. Someone saying, what do you want? Tell me what you want. I'm going to try to make that happen because I don't want to have to respond to this qualified written request. Or later on, if it gets into litigation, you do a deposition and some executive has to fly across the country to wherever you are to answer these questions. They're saying, I don't want to do this. Now you're inconveniencing an executive who's going to be on the phone with your attorney saying, what does your client want so I don't have to take that flight? I mean, these are things, little things, but you become the exception and you will get results and settle your debts at big discounts.
There aren't enough lawsuits against these disgusting lenders countrywide. You know, it's just disgusting, of course. Anthony Mozzillo, I think that's his name, right? You know, well, he got his hand slapped. He should have gone to jail. This predatory lending and all of the other scams that all of these scumbags pulled during, you know, that created the Great Recession, almost brought down the global economy, for God's sake. I mean, it's just mind-boggling that nobody's gone to jail. I mean, it's just insane. You know, no real regular everyday person could get away with this stuff. But when you're up in the, you know, the too big to fail halls of power, it's a whole different world, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's unfortunate. Yeah. But it shows how it shows all the challenges that we have in our country right now, which need to be remedied.
Yeah.
Like one way of sucking the money out of the elite is to stop paying them. And once you do, because the wages aren't going up. Most people aren't getting big, new, lucrative jobs. So the way to keep afloat, if you can't increase the income, is to reduce the expenses. And that's if you can't afford your bills, it's to stop paying them. And if you can't afford most of them, stop paying all of them and try to get deals on those you can and get rid of this debt.
Yep, that is, I call it the nuclear option, but I think it's very legitimate at some point. So at some times, you know, you need to do that. And millions of people did it, and many of them very successfully. So don't be afraid to do it yourself if you need to, folks. So more on that, you know, on upcoming shows. And, you know, hopefully this has been a resource for people. George, give out your website.
The website for our fund is ahpfund.com. The website for Debt Cleanse is debtcleanse.com.
Good stuff. Good stuff. George Newberry, thanks for joining us.
All right. I appreciate the time. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.